This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. What would you do if you only had a year or a month left to live? You might think that your priorities are universal, but you'd be surprised about the different answers that other people give. Dr. David Casserette says our diverse life experiences, cultures, values, and faiths play into our conception of a good end of life and a good death. He's had many of these conversations with patients and families. David is chief of palliative care and a professor of medicine at Duke University, and he's leading a panel discussion called Dignity, Diversity, and Visions of a Good Death. That's happening at Duke Chapel on February 23rd, and David Casserette joins me now. Welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
Linda Jacobs is here as well. She'll be speaking at the event. Welcome, Linda. Good to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Ronald Godby will participate as well. He's the lead pastor of River Church in Durham. Welcome.
It is my pleasure, sir. Thank you for allowing us to be here.
It's great to have you. David Casserette, let's talk about this because you talk with patients who come to you after receiving a terminal diagnosis. How many of them have thought about this or given much thought, can you tell, to the end of life, the end of their lives, and what they'll look like?
Yeah, I think the short answer is probably not very many, or if they've thought about it, they've thought about it in very general and sometimes unrealistic terms. I've certainly had patients reflect that if they were given a diagnosis like this, they've thought about it in the past and thought, oh, I'd take a trip, I'd climb Mount Everest, I'd go on a safari. And then in the moment, they realize that those things really aren't nearly as important as spending time with family, leaving a legacy for kids, or even getting their finances in order. So even those people who have thought about it, maybe haven't thought about it in the way that is most useful in the moment when they really need to make decisions.
In that moment, when they do come to you, what are some of the things they're saying that indicate what they'd really like to have? I think you've just indicated some of that, but tell us more about what it is they'd really like to do.
You know, sometimes the question that gets at what people really want to do is actually not so much what they want to do, but other related questions, like who is most important to them? And that's a question I often lead with. Who's most important in your life? Who do you want to remember you? Who do you want to make sure is taken care of after you die? And often starting with that who question, gets us into a much more meaningful conversation about what, and honestly takes us away from the bucket list conversations that I think are important to some people, but honestly maybe not as important to somebody who has a wife at home and kids to leave a diary to and other things that are much more important than going on some crazy trip on a motorcycle.
Linda Jacobs, you were very likely number one on your husband Gary's list if he were asked that question. He was diagnosed with ALS, and you had lived with that diagnosis for 5 years?
Three and a half years.
Mm-hmm. Tell us what that was like and give us a sense of your journey once you realized what that diagnosis was and what it meant.
Well, once we accepted the fact that it really was ALS, we were in denial in the beginning, but once it was confirmed, we, like you mentioned, we got our affairs in order, and Gary started, he transitioned from work to staying at home once he became weaker, and he loved his, we have one son, Alan, and we have lots of animals, cats and dogs, and rescue anything that walks through our yard, whether they need to be rescued or not. And we enjoyed our time at home, and he was able to navigate around the house with a walker, and Sunday nights was hockey night for Al's hockey game, and we managed to get him there, initially in a walker, then a wheelchair, and then a wheelchair and a ventilator, but he still made the games.
What were his priorities once he realized that he had so little time left?
Initially, his priorities were making sure we were taken care of financially. And then for 3 years, he literally sent me emails telling me who to call for plumbing, electrician, sent me electric diagrams.
I think you've said you've got a book of these,
I have a
right?
book of emails. Yes, I do. And how to turn the generator on, and I had to do monthly generator checks, start it up, make sure it went, and he just wanted to make sure we were able to function once he wasn't there to take care of us.
Ronald Godbee, let me ask you the kind of conversations that you have with people in your congregation about death. Do you have these conversations?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that's the key thing, is that these are conversations that we need to have. A lot of times, especially in a faith-based context, these are the very things that we stay away from, and how unfortunate that is. You know, this is the inevitable. One thing that you'll never do is get out of life alive. But these are the very conversations that we don't have. And so trying to get people to become comfortable with the conversation, to get them to understand that, no, you're not abandoning your faith. This is a part of your faith. And you're not abandoning the principles of life, but this is equally a part of life. And to help them to at least embrace it and have some level of comfortability with it is what our goal is with all of our parishioners and everyone that we deal with.
You said that this is a difficult conversation to have often, particularly in the faith context. Why particularly in a faith context?
Yeah, because in some pseudo way, we believe that we, by faith, can remedy these things. And by faith, we can pray and God will remove this from them. And so to be a good Christian in our context means to believe in God with this radical faith. And in actuality, radical faith is a dependency upon God, not to remove it, but to wrap yourself around him, even in the most difficult scenarios and circumstances. So it is not the absence of faith. It is faith to embrace this part of life.
What about the sense, too, that if that this is some kind of punishment, and if you are good, it'll be lifted from you? Is that part of what you're having?
Oh, absolutely. And that's an improper theology. You know, when we approach death as a punishment and not the promise and the reward that it is explained to be scripturally, then, of course, we then believe that God is just being bad towards us when people are dying, when in actuality, this is a reward being given to us. And it is something that should be embraced and understood, not as something that puts us in opposition with God, but it's because he is a loving, kind, and embracing God that he's given us this opportunity.
David Casaret is as one who delivers palliative care and has conversations with many, many people in the community. Do you see differences, cultural, religious differences on the way people perceive death?
In the way that they perceive death, I think to follow on what Pastor Godbee was saying, yes, definitely. And not just the way they perceive death, but the way that they perceive those events that lead up to death. And the way that people think about the role of medical treatment. I think sometimes some of my patients embrace the most aggressive treatment possible as long as possible, because to do anything less would be to renounce or to be seen as renouncing their faith. It's almost a test of faith, how willing they are to keep pushing. And a related theme, which could be very, very difficult, I think, for healthcare providers, is when some of my patients think of the pain or discomfort that goes along with some advanced serious illnesses like cancer as somehow repayment of a death. I've heard patients tell me, I'd rather burn in this world than the next one, and are unwilling to take pain medication for cancer. And obviously that's their choice. And I don't mean to disrespect that, but it can be also very difficult for us as healthcare providers to watch that suffering, knowing that there's something we can do about it. So not only are there differences, but there are differences, I think, that many of us as healthcare providers need to come to grips with and wrestle with in our own consciences and how we practice healthcare ourselves.
Linda Jacobs, tell me a little bit about your husband, Gary, and how he viewed this, especially with respect to the possibility of pain and discomfort. Did you talk about that?
Well, first of all, he was a gem. He never complained, not once, and never said, why me? He smiled every day, and he was so easy to take care of. And I was fortunate enough to be home to take care of him through that time, along with Al. And he embraced life, and he dealt with his declining health. He knew for a fact that he wanted to pass at home, and On one occasion, I had to take him to the emergency room, and we were driving down the driveway, and I looked over at him, and he was crying because he thought he was not coming back. So I said, we're going to get you back, and we did. And I knew from that point forward I was going to make that happen. I was going to find a way for him to pass at home with his family, with his cats and dogs, and we were very, very fortunate to be able to make that happen for him.
Well, and it took a lot of work, too, right?
It did.
Because in order to have hospice in your case, even though hospice would offer home care, it was particularly complicated in your case.
It was complicated because Gary made a conscious decision to be removed from the ventilator. We weren't making the decision for him to take him off of life support. It was totally his decision, and he told us when he was ready. He communicated with his iPad. He texted and emailed Al and I and everybody, and he said, "When I can no longer hold that stylus pen, I'm done because I will not be able to communicate, and I'm not going to lay in bed and blink at people to try to make them understand me." So he knew when it was time. And I started making calls, looking for someone to help us. And Duke Hospice immediately, they actually came to our house that very day to talk to Gary and I. And they had to jump through hoops to make it happen because of the medication that was involved. The sedation process took an entire week. They started the sedation on Tuesday. And he passed on Friday morning in our living room. Mm. Peacefully and with music in the background. It was wonderful. I mean, it was exactly what he had wanted, and I was so thankful.
Did you find yourself, especially in the initial stages, not so much not wanting to talk about this, but you talked about being in denial, the idea that he may have been ready and starting to accept it, and you simply weren't. You're about to lose your husband. You can't
right.
accept this. How is that
for I
you?
Did struggle with that, although I promised him that I would honor his wishes. But We had been together since high school, so it was 44 years. We literally grew up together. And he would keep saying, I don't know how much longer I can do this. So we would have a good cry, and that moment would pass. But I could see as his health was deteriorating, the time was getting closer, and we would have to honor his request.
Reverend Godby, talk about that willingness to have a good cry, which is, I think, the thing we really try to avoid most.
Oh, absolutely. And first of all, let me celebrate this hero sitting to the right of me and all the caregivers. You know, they're just that. And thank you for having the courage to tell your story. But again, you know, in a faith-based context, you know, we're taught, hey, be strong, you know. But one of the greatest strengths that you can have is being vulnerable. And we don't teach people that grieving is a process and it's a healthy part of the process. And so we say, hey, don't cry. You know, I've heard so many people stand at caskets of loved ones and tell small children, hey, don't cry, be strong. They want you to be strong. No, they need you to have a good cry. Every tear is earned. And I tell people at funerals, cry all you need to, because those tears are reflective of the investment and the deposit that that person has made in your life. And it's healthy to let those emotions show forth. The problem is that when grieving becomes a way of life, so it has its place in life, but it shouldn't become a way of life. And so at some point, we do need to heal. Those tears need to go from falling down our face to creating smiles on our face. And so to have people help us on that journey to get those, to get us out of that unhealthy place into a healthy place is what all of us needs.
You had an experience just recently. You lost your father not long ago.
Yes, sir. No more than a month ago. And what a beautiful thing it was. And that is always my wife and I, our goal with our children is to, again, make this a part of our narrative. Not to excuse it away, not to explain it away, but to embrace it and to help our children understand the importance of this thing called death. And so her dad lived with us for the last 6 years and just recently went home to what we would say to be with the Lord. And our children were there. And as we stood around his bedside and as my daughter patted him on the head, which was his just love and his pride and joy. And she said, good night, Granddad. And as she patted him on his head, he took his last breath, and they were able to see the beauty of that moment and not to reject it, but to embrace it.
Dr. Kasseret, I wonder how you have these conversations with people. Given your role, it's a pretty complex one. You've got a lot of medical things to think about. There's a lot of, chemistry involved here that is a big part of your profession. And then all that you're hearing from Linda and from Ronald about these accepting grief and making death a part of your life. How do you integrate that? And are you able to have those conversations with people in your position?
I certainly am, and not just me, but other palliative care professionals, the chaplains and social workers and nurses I work with. That's our job, and that's what we do. And I think it's often easier for us because we come in often to a patient's care as outsiders in a sense. We're not necessarily as focused on looking at the CT scan, evaluating a patient for the next round of chemotherapy, assessing them for a transplant. We do that. I mean, we're medical professionals. I'm a board-certified physician. But we also have the mental and emotional space and the time to have other conversations, too. And sometimes I'll just compartmentalize those discussions, go and visit a patient in the morning to talk about pain management, and then come back in the afternoon and say, we're not going to talk about pain management. We're not going to talk about your scans. We're going to talk about what you're hoping for and what you're afraid of. And we'll talk about who's important to you and how you'd like to spend your time. Because those sorts of conversations get lost in all of the hurry and rush of getting the scan or reviewing that blood test or changing this or that medication. And that's a shame. We really need to make time for those conversations.
What do you think are some of the biggest barriers? I suppose there's a great deal of diversity, and that's a big part of your panel discussion, the many ways in which people understand and plan for the end of life. But what are some of the barriers to having those conversations and allowing the grief to pour in?
I think the other panelists, who I'm very grateful for sharing their stories, can give you a sense of those barriers, too. I could start the discussion by saying it's just not something we like to talk about. Talking about it, even about somebody else, means facing our own mortality. Talking to a patient and the choices that he or she would make mean me having to think about the choices that I'll have to make someday. So even for us as healthcare providers, it means a very rude encounter with our own mortality. And that's true whether you're talking with a patient or friends or family members. And at least as a healthcare professional, I'd also say it's a matter of time. We just don't give healthcare professionals the time that they need to have these discussions. And so my usual advice is for my patients to start having those discussions with friends and family members to get more comfortable. And so when you have time with a healthcare provider, you're ready. You've thought through some of these things.
And Ronald Godbee, I suppose your father-in-law's example, as you tell the story, also suggests the wisdom of those who are in the dying process. They know a lot more than maybe we give them credit for. He knew that he didn't want to be. Tell us a story about his last few days.
Yeah, so Dad, was just the epitome of excellence, and he didn't want anything in his environment out of alignment. And so hospice brings in this chair. And thank God it's a brand new chair because Dad doesn't want anything used. And so we think because it's brand new, he's going to embrace this chair and love it. But he rejects this chair. And for the life of us, we couldn't figure out what was his opposition with this brand new chair that was going to help him get up and down. And he was adamant in the fact that he was not going to sit in this chair. And so we couldn't make the parallel until after he passed. And the parallel was that he and our mom would always do visits to assisted living facilities. And they would always do hospital visitation. And so even though we thought that he couldn't draw a parallel between what was going on, because we tried to keep the fact that he was in hospice care away from him, he was able to recognize the things that was coming into his environment.
And it changed his environment.
And he changed and said he didn't want to have anything to do with that chair.
I want to thank you all for being on our program today. Ronald Godbee, lead pastor at River Church in Durham. Linda Jacobs is going to join them on a panel discussion with Dr. David Kasseret, who's the chief of palliative care and a professor of medicine at Duke. Thank you all for being on our program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Got more information on that panel at our website, stateofthings.org, and live music just ahead. Stay tuned.